the one. I see a man who looks like Damien Karras.
If you looked with the eyes of faith, you'd see me.
No, I am not! I'm alive! I go on! I breathe! Look at me!
I believe in death. I believe in disease.
Boy, I've been crucified. I've just never seen anything like this in 20 years.
I believe in justice and in humanity and torture and anger and hate.
The killer drove an ingot into each of his eyes and cut off his head.
It's a wonderful life, in fact. I believe in murder. I believe in pain. I believe in cruelty and infidelity.
You believe in possession, Father?
He is inside with us! He will never get away! His pain won't end!
I believe in slime and stink and in every crawling, putrid thing, every possible ugliness and corruption, you son of a bitch! I believe in you.
Exorcist 3 is, in my mind, one of the very best sequels, probably in any genre, because I think it takes a component of what worked really well about the original film and kind of runs in a completely different direction with it. In my mind, in this world of really unnecessary follow-ups, I think that's really how you do a sequel and keep things feeling fresh and fascinating.
That was Matt Serafini talking about William Peter Blatty's 1990 film, The Exorcist III. Mr. Serafini is an author who's written such novels as Island Red, Under the Blade, Feral and its prequel Devil's Row, and the short story collection All Night Terror with Adam Caesar. He's also written for genre websites Shock Till You Drop and Dread Central, and participates in the latter site's podcast Dinner for Fiends. Feeney, thanks so much for being on the show, sir.
Thank you very much for having me. I love this show.
Thank you very much. Now,
and that is not smoke blowing, though, by the way. Like, this is a really... in a world, and this might sound a little snobby, but in a world of substanceless podcasts, I will say, it's awesome to really just sort of see this show that is just a bunch of deep dives into one movie. And that's what I think a lot of people live for, is just kind of geeking out over one movie and kind of covering all there is to cover about it. So that's what you do really well here. And so I was really excited to be a part of it.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. You know, it's funny. It's sort of I feel lucky into having sort of stumbled onto the conceit for this podcast. I don't want to dive too much into the history of the podcast. We there have been different iterations and they didn't quite work, but I feel like one sort of led into what it is now. But it's sort of doing my favorite thing, which is whenever I catch a movie with a bunch of friends, inevitably my favorite part of the experience isn't always watching the movie so much as it is talking at length about the movie right after, that post movie chat. And that's kind of what I wanted this podcast to be at a certain point. And hopefully we're doing it well enough up until this point. So
I think you are. I think I think to your strength. And I think that just you personally do a very good job of that. It's not always, it's a hard thing to do, I think, especially articulating thoughts, and I think that's to your credit. That's not an easy thing to do, I think, for a lot of folks. Not easy for me to do. So I tip my hat to you there.
Thanks. I mostly just stumble through it as best I can, if I'm being honest.
Fair enough.
Now, can I ask, as we start out every episode, can I just ask, of all the horror movies you might have chosen, all the ones you've seen, all the ones you love, when asked to pick just one to talk about at length, you went with The Exorcist 3. Why is that?
I went with it because it's a favorite of mine. It always has been, but it's one of those movies where every time I watch it, and I watch it a lot, actually. Probably every 4 or 5 years, I take it out, dust it off, and pop it in. So I'm very familiar with it. But it's weird. It's one of those movies where every time I watch it, I kind of get obsessed with it all over again. And it's not just like a movie that I watch and then go, okay, yep, that's still very good, put it back on the shelf, and that's the end of it. It's like I end up just going back and reading, like, I'll submerge myself in kind of interviews with William Peter Blatty. I'll go back and look at trivia. I'll kind of, you know, scrounge the internet for every little bit of information that's out there. And I sort of live in that movie for a week or two after I revisit it. And so when you asked me, I had received the Scream Factory Blu-ray last week, and I had pre-ordered it through the website. Definitely.
Oh, that's right. They send them, what, like 2 weeks early if you pre-order?
Yeah. Apparently you and I are the only two people on this planet that do not get Scream Factory screeners. you know, whatever. Not bitter about it. Happy to support them. But so, yeah, you had asked me to do the show, and it was sort of right in the middle of me of kind of just geeking out over the movie all over again. A little more severe this time because of the long-awaited Legion cut that is included on this disc, which is, for longtime fans, is, you know, quality aside, the video quality aside, I'm sure it's going to be a treat for every single person to watch. So
it's a grail for some people, I think.
It totally is one of the great lost movies. And so, yeah, you asked, and it was sort of just, it seemed like the no-brainer to me.
Very cool. Yeah, I cannot wait to pick up that. I was telling you before the show began, my own copy is waiting for me 15 minutes away, but I just haven't been able to lay my hands on it yet. And I can't wait to dive in because I'm a huge fan of the movie too. I have been since I was a kid. And can I ask before I reveal sort of how I came to the movie for the first time, how is it that you first stumbled across, you know, The Exorcist 3 or even The Exorcist? What was your first experience with that franchise?
Sure. I have older siblings, much older. So, I think we've talked before about kind of just getting into horror at a young age. And so I grew up and The Exorcist was already, I mean, even as a kid, it was already that household name, you know what I mean? And it was, as I was discovering various movies, that was always the one that I couldn't see yet. You know, I was too young. It was too intense. And it was just, you can see this, but you can't. No, not that one. And so, you know, obviously, what does that do to a kid? It makes you want to see that movie above all else. That's all you want to see. So, you know, I finally saw The Exorcist and it was terrifying to me. And I remember, it was just not being able to see. And it was the edited version that was on like WLVI channel 56 or something like that. So it didn't even have, you know, the most extreme moments in it, but it was terrifying to me. And I remember just trying to go to sleep that night. And every time I'd close my eyes, seeing Reagan's awful face, every time I would close my eyes, and it was awful, but exhilarating at the same time. And actually Exorcist 3 was, I think, started to be advertised not very long after that. And so I remember all the TV spots and the theatrical trailer. I don't think I ever saw the theatrical trailer, but the TV spots, all with that shot of Jesus opening his eyes, the statue of Jesus opening his eyes. And I was in fifth grade, and it was, and we were in a Catholic school, but it was all the kids could talk about was just that shot of Jesus opening his eyes. It was like this most singularly most terrifying image to everybody in that class. And I just remember everybody kind of talking about it in whispered in hushed tones, like, oh my God, that part where Jesus opens his eyes, and, you know, being surrounded, you know, by that iconography in our environment too, made it creepier. You know, it made it feel even more scarier. So I was primed perfectly for it. And Exorcist 3, I was not allowed to see at the theater. My dad might have been on the cusp, but it was my mother who just sort of was like, no. And so the compromise was, well, we'll get it right when it comes out on video. So I don't remember how long the window was, probably about a year at that time. But so it was the year after, whenever it was a new release on video, is when I finally got to see it for the first time.
I recall. Now, did you see The Exorcist 2 in between 1 and 3, or?
I don't remember, actually. It's funny, and I think you and I our opinions probably differ a little bit on Exorcist 2.
I think there's only one opinion to have on the film. I don't know that there would be any differing opinions whatsoever.
Well, you know, what's funny is on, I think it's, if you don't mind, a little teaser of the Scream Factory Exorcist 3 disc on the making of documentary. I think the introduction to Brad Dourif on it, he just says, Exorcist 2, I hated it. I hated Exorcist 2, as did everybody else. It was a piece of shit. The worst movie I've ever seen. Probably the worst movie of all time. And no, you know what? I will just say I don't want to even really bog down too much on Exorcist 2, except to just say,
go ahead and tear into it, because I'm the guy who defends Blair Witch 2. So you know what? I can't knock anybody for liking The Heretic. So please.
No. Blair Witch 2 is a much better film. But Exorcist 2, they talk about this a little bit on the Legion documentary as well, but, it's too weird, but, you know, it's expensive, and it has an attractive pedigree to it, and I can't say it was well made, because it's actually not. The performances are sort of all over the place, and the movie really has seemed to have no idea what it's doing, but there's so many interesting sequences in it that, even though it amounts to nothing and it's sort of this hammy affair, I kind of wind up appreciating it a little bit. Although I will say, every time I watch it, I go, yeah, that's why you only watch this movie, you know, 3 or 4 times. But to get back to your original question, I don't remember when I actually saw The Exorcist 2 for the first time. I think it was later on, actually. I don't think I had seen it in between 1 and 3.
I got you. I came to the franchise in sort of a weird way. I was just starting to get into horror films when I was a teenager, and you know, getting over my my sort of ingrained fear of them from, you know, childhood. And the one that I always knew that I couldn't handle, you know, I was watching slasher movies. I was watching every John Carpenter movie I could get my hands on. You know, there was this great video store in the neighboring town that had, like, apparently the person who ran it was a horror fiend, because the horror section was massive and
nice,
you know, like 3 times the size of, you know, romance or drama or even action, you know? And so I started working my way through all of these franchises, and it was a rare thing for a single video store to have every Nightmare on Elm Street on VHS, every Friday the 13th, every, you know, whatever. And so I was working my way through these, and I would always pass The Exorcist. And just the way that people spoke about that movie.
Yeah.
I was like, this movie is not for me. Like, that is
psyched out, right?
Like, God, totally.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you just know that you can't do it. You can't handle that. You know, not at like 12 or 13, but yep. I was in a used bookstore, and there was this old tattered copy, purple cover of, you know, The Exorcist, the, you know, like it was a 70s paperback. Mm-hmm. And I was like, maybe I could do this. I could read it. You know, I could handle that. And so I remember finishing the book outside by a pool in the middle of summer, as all of my friends were in the pool, like asking why the hell. And I was like, you don't understand. I've been reading this. I can't tear myself away from this book. So it's like, it's 90 degrees out. The sun is like baking me. And yet I kid you not, I'm not making this up. I there's like a chill running down my spine as I finish this book. And as soon as I did, I was like, I don't care if that movie ends me. I need to see it. And I need to see it as quickly as possible. So the next order of business was getting to that same video store, and I rented The Exorcist 1, 2, and 3. And late one night, I watched the first one, and it wrecks me. And what's crazy is, you know, watching it pan and scan, you know, like just awful full frame, you know, VHS.
Yep.
It still, it had, you know, it was the first time I saw it, of course. So, you know, oh my God, it did a number on me. But its impact hasn't dimmed on me. Like, if I can pop in the Blu-ray tonight, and it's still going to have pretty much the same effect. It is one of the very few horror movies that whose power never dims.
I agree. And I think it's a testament to just how brilliantly made it is. Because,
it's perfect.
I mean, I've seen it, you know, so many times too. And even my wife, who isn't a big rewatcher, you know, if she sees something once, she's good. She's basically good. But, you know, I mean, she's been married to me long enough where, like, she's going to rewatch some movies, you know, but she's okay with seeing that, again and again. And she even remarks just how good, like, some of the acting is, like Ellen Burstyn. I think she finds, is kind of probably, like, as we all do, that there's just so much to look at and to focus on in that movie that it's just, it's such a rich experience.
Oh, it really is. And to teenage me, it was just, it felt life changing in a way. Like, I felt shook to my core watching that movie. And then I popped in The Exorcist 2. And it was like a weird palate cleanser in a way. Like, it wasn't a comedy, but it wasn't a horror movie. And I just kind of sat there and watched it. And I'm
was this like the next night, or was this right after?
No, I did a triple feature that night. Oh, I had to watch them all. You know, it was a very late night with a lot of conflicting emotions. But, I finished the first one. I watched the second one. And, you know, I loved seeing Reagan again. And I loved seeing, you know, Marin again. But the movie just didn't do it for me. I was like, how do you go from the first one? How do you go from that story to this? And I almost didn't want to put the third one in. I was like, if the second one was that bad, how can I even get through a third? Maybe I should just go ahead and take these back and just let the first one live in my memory at this point as being a great, well, no, I rented it, I'm going to watch the damn thing. And 5 minutes in, the third one had me. I was like, oh, this feels like a true sequel. This feels like a natural extension to the first film, which is crazy considering that the plot couldn't be more different. I mean, they're two very different films that just happen to share the same world.
Yep. Yeah, and I think that's a good point. Is one of the things about that movie is it draws you in. You know right away. It's such a gripping movie from the opening frames of it. And it has you. It casts that spell.
Yeah, it wasn't until later that I realized that the guy who made The Exorcist 3 was the novelist who gave us the source material for the first film. And, you know, I wonder if I'd known that at the time, if I'd have, I might have been a little bit wary of watching. It's like, okay, if you didn't have the filmmaker who crafted the first one, you know, is this some sort of vanity project in the way the fact that, you know, Blatty is wanting to direct now, you know?
Right.
And he's only getting to by virtue of the fact that, you know, he is the creator, right? But no, you watch that movie, he was a hell of a director.
Great director, yeah. Well, have you seen his other movie, The Ninth Configuration?
I never have. That movie has slipped through my fingers. It's not like it's hard to get a hold of, but I've had so many near misses with watching that movie and catching it. And I just, for whatever reason, I have not made it to that film yet. And I don't know why. I can't even say why. I feel like I'm about 20 years too late. Like, I should have seen it many, many times over, but no, I haven't.
I don't know. I mean, no, it's a weird one. You say it's easy to come by. I think it is now. I mean, I have the Blu-ray of it, but I think it was on DVD, but it was a very early DVD. Like, it wasn't anamorphic, and I think it was out of print quickly and for a long time. So I don't know that it was, I mean, I don't know that it was the easiest thing to come by, and kind of obscure. I mean, I'd never seen it in a video store or anything like that. A friend of mine lent it to me in college. That was how I came across it. But the only reason I mention it is just to say that, you know, yeah, I mean, his directing chops, you can see them in Ninth Configuration just as they are in Exorcist 3. They're very, I mean, they're not similar stories, although they do share some thematic similarities. But his direction, even in that movie, is full of wit, visually interesting. And so, you know, if you had seen that before Exorcist 3, it probably wouldn't be surprising. Although, you know, the way, you know, we're a bit younger and behind that curve. So, yeah, I mean, I saw it after the fact, too. But it's a shame that Blatty did not direct more because, yeah, as you said, I dare say he was a great director.
Oh, he absolutely was. He had like a perfect command of, you know, the tone. Again, you know, within 5 minutes, you know exactly where you are. You have that chill running down your spine. You're immediately sort of set upon with that anxiety that you had in the first film that, you know, the Friedkin created, you know, almost immediately. And, you know, I wonder what the rest of the man's filmography might have looked like had he continued directing.
I know. And Yeah, it's The Exorcist, the original movie, has, you know, with the Father Marin stuff in Iraq at the beginning, and there's this idea of kind of this pervasive element of evil, and it's everywhere, and you see it, you know, when he's in the office and the clock stops, and then, you know, Friedkin drags some of that stuff into Georgetown, and you just feel like that evil is everywhere, and in Exorcist 3, Blatty almost picks it up right there, where it's, you know, it blows the church doors open, it's walking the streets, and it's just sort of around every corner. And I love that sort of thematic cohesion between the two movies, and it nicely pushes The Exorcist 2 out of your out of your memory almost immediately.
Oh, totally.
No, that did not happen.
No, I gotta, you know, it's funny, I haven't revisited The Heretic in ages. Is there anything in the third film that rewrites two out of existence, or does it merely sort of ignore it?
It just ignores it. I mean, I think if I remember right, the only real mention of The Exorcist, even really in Exorcist 3, is just sort of a vague, Karras did the exorcism on that McNeil girl or something. I think it's very vague, isn't it? From what I remember.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I think the only connection is like Kinderman and Dyer and Karras, which is, you know, it's such a strange film. It's a strange sequel, I should say, in that, you know, part of the plot is entirely dependent on that first film. And yet it also feels like it's mostly a standalone film. You know,
right.
It's its own thing, which I kind of love that for it. But, you know, I even looking at the first film is a possession flick. You know, it's a full on horror movie, and you get to 3 and it's a procedural. At times,
yeah.
You know, the horror is there, but it's sort of just seeping in around the edges, and, you know, more so and more so by the time you get to the final third of the film. But yeah, it feels like obviously it's part of the same world, but they're very different films, and they're kind of independent of one another for the most part.
No, I agree. And I think Blatty, even in the new, there's a pretty decent interview with him. It's a lengthy one. It's like, fortunately it's audio only. So they play it. They just play it over the Legion cut, but it's like a good hour and 40 minute interview. And I think Blatty even says, you know, I never thought of this as a sequel per se, more of just a spinoff, because I liked the Kinderman character when I was writing him in the first book and, kind of just wanted to use him again. And the thing that's interesting about Exorcist 3 is it's almost a sequel to the book, because, you know, the great friendship between Karras and Kinderman that is sort of drives the narrative really doesn't exist in Friedkin's movie, because, you know, they Karras and Kinderman, yeah, they have a couple of scenes, they get along, but that great friendship isn't in the movie, because the book takes place over more time and there's more of a sense of them becoming friends. So it's interesting, you know, when you have with this sort of retconning in the third movie of them being the best of friends. And if you only have the original movie to look at, it's kind of like, when did that happen?
It is kind of strange. I mean, I think if people were only familiar with the movies, there would be this feeling that Kinderman was a bit desperate to have friends in a way, not only with,
right.
You know, the way he, you know, when he says, you know, Father Karras was a great man, I loved him, he was my best friend. It's like, what? Were you you spoke to him twice? I mean, he was a great man, clearly, but maybe you're projecting a little bit too much. But also, like, you know, you look at his friendship with Father Dyer, and like, he's obviously very protective of him and very worried about his health. And, you know, but even that feels like, yeah, I mean, it's a natural extension of the first film, especially the version you've never seen, you know, when they sort of walk off into the sunset together, you know,
right.
Arm in arm almost, you know. So
right.
You understand how we could get there. But yeah, Kinderman seems like a guy who probably, yeah, he has a family and he has Dyer, but he's not a guy who has many friends. So I think
right.
He probably puts a lot into the few friendships that he has. So maybe it wouldn't be too surprising that he would think of Karras as, you know, Karras and he being best buddies, as it were.
That's a good point. I mean, and it's funny too, because yeah, Kinderman is a weird character, a quirky character. You know, he's just his dialogue is he's very quick witted, but he's just awkward. He's an awkward kind of a guy. And you know, I had mentioned to you the other day, as when I because I knew we were going to talk Exorcist 3, I just sort of picked up my old Legion paperback and was just kind of intended to just thumb through it. I just wanted to kind of get a sense of it, because it's been years since I've read that, and I ended up rereading almost the entire. I haven't finished it yet. I have like, I think 100 pages left. But it just, that sucked me back in, and I just couldn't stop reading it. Over 2 days, I read 200 pages, and I think what I'm getting out of that book, I think it's a great book, and I loved it even when I read it the first time. But you know, Kinderman is a strange character in that there's a notion of that maybe he's going senile, and it's never explicitly stated, but it's introduced almost right away, and it's carried through the book that he just forgets little things here and there, and he's always trying to figure out, kind of, he's always grappling with, he has this inkling like, this is supernatural. I don't want to admit it, but he knows pretty early on, from the first murder of Thomas Kintry, he knows, okay, this is not a real thing. And so he's sort of grappling with that. And there's all these long digressions, that Blatty goes into in Kinderman's head, as he's wrestling with that, you know, and how do you reconcile with this kind of supernatural evil that's here that shouldn't be here, you know, at the bookend of a career of a 45 year detective career where you've seen it all, but you haven't seen this. And I think some of that's probably informed by what happened in the original Exorcist, although, he doesn't ever really say that, but I think that's clearly sort of the jumping off point is like, he knew, you know, in his gut of guts, something was awry with the McNeil thing. And I think that's probably where we pick up at the start of Legion, even though it's, I think the book is 12 years after the Exorcist, but you know, I think that's why he's so, kind of terrified by this other thing that he's now forced to contend with.
Yeah. And you know, it's funny. I haven't read the novel in some years. I remember loving it when I read it, and I remember finding it to be even better than the movie, which, you know, I loved the movie, but the book felt richer in many ways, you know, as books do, even if they're adapted to film by their authors, but yeah, which is rare. I said that like it happens all the time.
But, I know. It's so rare, yeah.
You know, it is weird in that I remember Kinderman having a much different arc. Well, if not a different arc, then a much different resolution to his arc in the book compared to the movie. You know, at the end of the movie, he is, you know, when Karis or Patient X or, you know, the Gemini, when they hurl him against the wall with their demonic power, they're holding him in place and they ask him if he believes. And he comes back with essentially saying that, yeah, he believes, but he believes in everything that's tangible about the world, everything that's evil in the world, but the things that you can touch, like, you know, I believe in slime. I believe in filth.
I believe in rot.
Yeah. Which is such a great performance, but you know, and we never really get much past that. I mean, here's a guy who is holding on to that with dear life, even as he's being confronted with what is obviously a supernatural event, you know?
Right.
Whereas in the novel, if I recall correctly, I remember being absolutely sort of, you know, as a reader, devastated by Kinderman's ultimate stance on what humanity and existence is at the end of the book, which, and correct me if I'm wrong, because it has been years, but ultimately that, you know, sort of the creation of the universe coincides with Lucifer falling. Mm-hmm. And as a result, all of humanity and indeed all of existence is essentially Satan. And so it's, you know, the notion of existence and, you know, human beings living and dying and, you know, the great struggle, as it were, you know, is all about Lucifer sort of ascending back to the light or sort of trying to put himself back together in some way. And I remember thinking that, you know, that's such a different place to land for that character than he does in the movie.
That's exactly right. That's exactly what he ends up concluding at the end of the book. And that's, you know, that's the ultimate takeaway, because, you know, where I am as I'm rereading it, you know, that's exactly what he's trying to comprehend, man's place in this kind of greater design. And I think if I remember right, some of the critics of Legion they hit on Blatty for giving Kinderman sort of a voice that I guess you would say it's from the school of intelligent design theory, which is, I don't know too much about it, but it's a theory of creationism that obviously isn't much of a theory because it's backed a lot by the Bible essentially instead of, you know, something provable. So I remember a lot of people sort of saying like, well, that's, you know, Blatty gets into that hokum. But to me, it's like, oh, you know, I mean, Kinderman doesn't need to, you know, Kinderman's a detective. He's a detective from a, you know, at this point, you know, he's from a different time. He grew up in a different era. And I mean, to me, there's nothing wrong with giving a character sort of a more old school sort of religious approach. That doesn't bother me. And that's not Blatty necessarily preaching to us, saying this is what you need to believe. I mean, that's sort of just what Kinderman ends up sort of working through.
I never got the feeling that Kinderman's stance was necessarily the same as Blatty, the author's, you know?
Right, right. And that's kind of how I feel about it. So, but no, you're right. And I think that my problem is that with the movie, and if I do have a problem, it's that, yeah, Kinderman's arc is a little strange in that I don't think it puts the correct button on it.
No.
In the theatrical cut. Now, obviously, a lot of that has to do with the reshooting of the, including the exorcism in the third act, which, as you know, was not originally intended to be there. But it's funny too, because I, as much as the exorcism, the climactic exorcism of Patient X, as much as visually it's kind of neat, the older I get and the more I watch the movie, the less I like that.
Yeah.
It ends up feeling like the weakest stuff in the movie to me.
Same here. And, like all of the more supernatural stuff in the movie, like not just that, but even... Yeah, I'm okay with some of the dream sequence stuff, like, you know, the Statue of Christ, like the eyes opening. But, you know, even the very opening of the movie, which I just admitted that I really dig and it pulls me into the movie. But, you know, there is one shot of, like, you know, it's a reverse shot of like fog creeping down those Georgetown steps. And yeah. I'm like, it's a little hokey. And then when we get like a woman crawling on the ceiling above Kinderman, I'm like, yeah, it's a little hokey. You know, and it's the same thing with... You know, I believe at the end of the novel, Legion, it ends with a conversation between Kinderman and Karis. And I understand, like, you know, if you're going to slap The Exorcist 3, if you're going to slap a title on that movie, they're going to want a big climax, I'm sure. But I still like the movie. I still like the ending of the movie, but it does feel, it feels like a step down. It feels like a tad weaker than the movie preceding it.
Yep, I agree completely. And it's funny, too, because the main reason why I think I went to just look through Legion and ended up rereading most of it was I could have sworn, and I mean, spoilers for anyone who hasn't read the book, but I could have sworn the book ended with Kinderman coming into, in the book, I think his name is Tommy Sunlight. That's what they call him.
They
ended up, I could have sworn it ended with him coming into Sunlight's cell and just shooting him. But when I read that first, because I was curious, and I don't know what my memory of it was, because I think Sunlight just sort of willfully, or I don't know if it's willfully, but he has a heart attack and just dies.
Yeah, I think if I recall correctly, I think it's just a simple conversation where the Gemini sort of admits that, he doesn't need to kill anyone. I think he driven by his father?
His father.
And once he finds out that his father is gone, he's sort of, either he forces it or he simply allows Karis's damaged body to just finally expire.
Yep. Yeah, that's it. And that's why I was like, okay, my memory of this is not, this isn't what I remember. So that's kind of why I went back. And, but in the Legion cut on the Blu-ray, I won't ruin the ending of it.
No, please.
It's not. Well, it's, this is the weird thing, is that that my memory of what happens in the book is the ending in the Legion cut. I didn't know that that's how that ended. So I was just like, where did this come from? This weird, I mean, I must've read it somewhere or something. And then that must've just, I don't know. I must've thought, yeah, that's how the book ends. I don't know. It was really weird how that worked.
How Kinderman winds up in, does he land in a place closer to the book, or does it more or less follow the same broad beats as the original cut of the film, would you say?
Well, the problem is, even though it's a really great to see the Legion cut as it's presented on that disc, like, you're never gonna show, like, if you were to show this movie to somebody who had never seen it for the first time, you wouldn't show them this cut,
right?
Because it is, unfortunately, it is still curiosity. It's not like Nightbreed where there's sort of like two flavors to choose from now. You know what I mean? And that's unfortunate. I mean, look, if the footage isn't there, if you can't find it, you can't find it.
And they're heroes for putting it out anyway. I adore Scream Factory. I mean, it seems like they're run by fans who have the same desires that we do for finding things that shouldn't exist and putting them out there. I mean, not only the Nightbreed director's cut, which, how insane is it that exists? We were told for 25 years it would never exist, and now it exists in the most perfect form it possibly could. You know, we've been told for years that we would never have a Halloween box set because, you know, the rights are split across so many different companies. Well, damn it, Scream Factory made that happen. And now, with The Exorcist 3, I got to admit, and I feel bad about this, but it only lasted for 2 seconds. I mean, it's not like I took to Twitter and started bashing them. They earn a free pass for anything they do from here on out to me. I mean, I will never give them hell. But, you know, when they announced The Exorcist 3 and that they were going to put the director's cut on there and that it was going to be in a lower quality version, you know, like VHS, I think it is. Or, you know, I remember thinking, well, that's what they said about Nightbreed, but it's Morgan Creek 2 and they're going to find the film elements and they're going to clean them up and we're going to have this. Yeah. And then it never happened. And my initial thought was kind of like, I wanted another impossible thing. Two impossible things.
Damn it.
Exactly. It's like, stop being lazy. Just get in there and start just digging through film if you have to. But no, I think it's amazing that they even put it out. But you're right. I mean, if you're going to turn somebody onto the film, you can't do it with a compromised version like that.
No. And I mean, the inserts, I think it is SVHS. They're still watchable and better than I expected. But the inserts are still VHS. What's interesting about it is that I'd seen the movie enough, sadly, to note, but you know, the scenes of Kinderman talking to the Gemini, they're different takes. So I had just assumed that they had spliced Miller back, you know, into it here and there, and that the rest was sort of just what was done was done. But no, I mean, so what's interesting is that you get to see basically an entirely new Brad Dourif performance. And it's, I mean, it's funny because I love Jason Miller, but I did not miss him in the Legion cut.
Really?
No,
he's not in it at all?
He's not in it at all.
So is the plot point that it's Karras's body still there, or do they just do away with that entirely?
So going back to what you said at the beginning, you know, how Exorcist 3 sort of feels like, you know, its own thing, just using characters. I think that was the original intent, was, you know, as Blatty said, make a spinoff movie, but, you know, in a way sort of like Red, like Michael Mann's Manhunter and then Silence of the Lambs. Those two movies aren't necessarily, you know, the first and the second one, but they kind of are. I kind of feel like that was sort of the original conception here, was, you know, because there were scenes of Brad Dourif as the priest, as Karras. So they reshot the opening scenes, the ending of Exorcist 3 where Karras jumps out the window. That was reshot with Dourif. And so the idea was just that, not necessarily that Karras was trapped in the body that, but just that Karras's body was being used. You know, in the Legion book and in the Legion cut, Karras, I think, is gone. You know, Karras's soul is saved, basically. And I think that's probably the way it should be, because that's his victory at the end of The Exorcist, is like, you know, his sacrifice is like, okay, I've saved Reagan, and I've defeated this demon. My body's gone, but you know, my soul is sort of redeemed. And so Exorcist 3 cut sort of walks that back a little bit. I don't think it's a disastrous plot point or anything like that, but I kind of actually prefer the idea of just Karras's vessel being inhabited by the Gemini killer, as opposed to Karras's soul also being shackled in there somewhere.
I get what you're saying, and it does make the ending a bit more, yeah. Well, it feels triumphant by the time you get to The Exorcist. And yeah, when you get to 3, it's like, oh my God, how long has it been? 15 years that he's been basically tormented. But at the same time, this being a horror film, I dig that idea too, that Karras is this long suffering guy who, you know, he did a noble thing and he wasn't rewarded for it. But at the very end, he finally, you know, not only does he save himself in a way, but he saves Kinderman, you know?
Yeah. I agree. That's why I said I don't think it's detrimental, because I do kind of like that idea too. And the film geek in me liked seeing Jason Miller in that role again.
And he was so great too. I remember reading somewhere that he was not necessarily in the greatest shape, you know, when he was filming all of that stuff. But you could never tell it, because he, you know, for what limited time he has on screen, he's absolutely Father Karras again, you know?
Yeah, totally, yeah.
And he's so great, like, he immediately wins you over, and you know that, like, but he's also terrifying, too. I mean, when we're not seeing the Gemini, but the Gemini is still, like, asserting himself. Like, at the end, when the Exorcist is making his way to that room, and you see that close cut of Karras the yellow eyes. He's really chilling at times in the film, and his voice too, when he actually gets to use what sounds like his own voice, is just, I mean, it sends shivers, man.
Oh, I agree completely. And I do feel like, as much as I liked seeing the Legion cut, and I do like it, but again, I don't know if this is, you know, because again, this is, I think, sort of an approximation of what Blatty was doing.
Has he spoken out on it yet?
I don't know. Like, so even though they did talk to him and they got an interview with him on the disc, I don't think he was involved in the sort of restoration of the footage. I believe it was Cliff McMillan, Scream Factory producer, putting the footage together based on Blatty's script. And I know that there were certain scenes that they could not find, so they used the movie, the existing movie, to bridge some of those gaps. So I'm hesitant to say that, you know, okay, now I've seen the Legion cut and I can say that the other one was better, because I don't think that I mean, it's a coherent movie. It's not like you're going to watch it and it's like this, what the fuck? Like, but I mean, I think the idea is that it's still not necessarily or completely what Blatty had made. At least that's what I think. And so I think the problem I have with it, though, is Kinderman going in and really just shooting the Gemini. I don't know that that's a satisfying ending either.
Yeah, it's a bit too, I don't know, a bit too cop movie for my taste. I mean, just that notion, which, I mean, maybe that's the point, you know. I mean, the movie does feel like a procedural in the first half, and then slowly the horror starts to creep in. And, you know, I mean, maybe there's something to be said for Kinderman just walking in and, you know, executing the evil as opposed to fighting it on some sort of, you know, metaphysical level, as it were. But it does feel, you know, just hearing you describe it that way, it feels unsatisfying.
Yeah, I when it ended, and it's, I think it's about 10 minutes shorter than the theatrical cut, but it ended, and you know, to its credit, it's still a very engrossing movie, and there's a little subsection in the middle that was new, that basically deals with Kinderman figuring out, you know, he figures out for sure, okay, the man in the cell is my old friend, but if he's my old friend, then who the hell was buried in the cemetery, and how did Karras basically get out, you know? And so there's sort of this little subplot where of Kinderman sort of talking to people and figuring out like what happened with that and how the logistics of it, basically. It was really cool. And I like that a lot. So I don't want to take away anything from the cut. If as a fan of the movie, I think you'll enjoy watching it. I think everybody should check it out. It's really neat. But yeah, it's sort of like at the end of it, it's like, okay, what we have now are two movies that I think are really good. But neither of them are able to go that extra mile and become the masterpiece. And it's weird because I feel like I'm being really hard on Exorcist 3 and I fucking love it. But like,
the same,
I feel like I'm, yeah, I feel like I'm being very like detrimental to it. And it's tough love. I mean, I think I really, really love the friggin' movie, but I think I love it for all the reasons I haven't touched on yet. It's sort of like, those are my issues with it. And everything that I haven't brought up is the stuff that I love about the movie.
So among the things you love, George C. Scott?
So good.
He's incredible in the movie.
I mean, so good. And it's funny because before we get into that, I just wanted to go back and talk about your experience with Exorcist 2 and then going to 3. I screened 2 and 3 for two of my friends and my wife like 3 years, 2 or 3 years ago. They hadn't seen... They'd never seen Exorcist 2, and only one of them had seen Exorcist 3. And I went, okay, come over. We'll have a double feature. And we watched Exorcist 2, and nobody wanted to watch Exorcist 3. Everybody was like, no, I'm done. I can't. My wife was pissed. She was like, what the fuck? That's so sick. You always do this. You always ruin the night, blah, 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 blah. I'm like, no, trust me. Within putting Exorcist 3 on, within 10 minutes, I just felt the room just change, like the atmosphere, all this tension, me putting in the disc going, guys, trust me, it's really good. And the tension just dissipated. By the time we got to Kinderman and Dyer, their little sort of date night, in the first act of the movie, everybody was giggling and laughing. And I was like, see, this movie just has magic, man. Like there's something, what George C. Scott and Ed Flanders is Dyer. I mean, what they're able to do in that movie, really in just a few quick scenes is remarkable.
Oh, absolutely. You get the entire history of those guys. I mean, never spelled out. It's never exposition, but just the way they interact with one another, you get the sense that, you know what that friendship has been like for the past decade and a half.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm always surprised when I rewatch it. In my mind, I'm always like, there's. I feel like there should be more of this stuff, but it's because it as you said, it's so realized that you know more about it than what you're shown in the movie. So you know, your mind sort of goes to all the places that the movie doesn't show you, but it's that's why I'm always like, oh, it feels like, you know, really, we're already here. Dyer's already going to be murdered. Like I can't believe it, you know. And it's because of that, because it is so perfectly done that you know, you feel like there's more of it than there is.
And you know, it's funny, you did mention that the movie at times feels like a sequel to the book, the original book, and not necessarily the movie. And I think I agree with you. There is that initial feeling because, you know, the Kinderman in this is George C. Scott. You know, the Father Dyer is an entirely different actor from, yeah, it doesn't really share any actors between movies except for Jason Miller as Karras. And yet, you know, within 2 or 3 minutes of seeing those guys, they are those guys. They are those characters. Like, I believe that, you know, is it Lee J. Cobb who played Kinderman in the first film?
Yeah.
You know, I believe that he got contacts and a toupee and shaved, you know, I mean, and now he is George C. Scott, you know, and same thing with Dyer. I mean, he got shorter and a bit more talkative. And, you know, they do such a great job in such a short amount of time of bringing us in as viewers and immediately liking those guys. And I think Scott is just incredible in the film. Like the sort of dialogue that he's given to chew on and how he can be charming at one moment and then genuinely threatening the next. I mean, you think about the scene where he visits Dyer in bed at the hospital, which is so great. And they're doing that friendly banter thing, but there is an edge to Scott's voice. You know, no, Kinderman absolutely. Is genuinely concerned, and he doesn't like being concerned. He doesn't like being vulnerable in that way. And there's that great moment where he keeps building and building, and he's still doing the playful, friendly banter thing, but he's getting angrier and angrier because Dyer is genuinely doing the banter thing and brushing it off like it's nothing. And then that poor nurse walks in and asks if everything's fine. He's like, "It's fine!" You know, it's, he's so great in that role. And it occurs to me, like, I wish... You know, we got The Changeling, and we got The Exorcist 3. You know, the collection of George C. Scott horror is relatively small. But I wish that the man had dove into the genre more often than he did. I think those are the only two that he did. I might be wrong about that, but
no, I think you're right. I think that's it. And no, you're absolutely right. George C. Scott, I mean. There's a lot of other great things about the movie, but if you had the wrong Kinderman, I don't think it would be as strong as it is. George C. Scott commands a lot of that movie, and you're right. I mean, a lot of it though too is Blatty's dialogue. Blatty writes better dialogue than I think he's given credit for.
Oh, that's excellent.
There's like almost like a Tarantino kind of poetry to his dialogue, and when you finally see the Ninth Configuration, you'll get that in spades in there too. It's that same sort of like colorful snappiness, but with kind of a philosophy underneath it. And it's just, but you're right. Like, what an actor like George C. Scott, who's a great actor, like what they can do with that. Like you said, like, you know, there's not a line in the movie where Kinderman says, "I'm concerned and I don't feel like I hate being concerned," but that's in there. You know, and that's a combination of the dialogue, you know, Blatty directing it that way, but certainly Scott putting that in the performance. And it's that nuance and that texture that I think is just, it makes that movie such a treat to watch over and over again.
And he's so great. He excels in those moments where he's playing, you know, he's kind of playing a tough guy who has no interest in being a tough guy, you know, yep. Like he, and that had to have been a tight wire walk of a thing to do as a performer to nail that, you know. And, you know, I'm thinking of like that moment where, you know, Dyer has just died and he's trying to explain the notion of this idea that the Gemini copycat isn't actually a copycat because he's doing things that the original killer did. And he's got that gnat of a human being buzzing in his ear, interrupting him every other word. And he's still upset that his friend died or whatever. And he's trying to explain this. And the guy keeps... And then finally he explodes. And you get the feeling like Scott was a big guy. He could throttle that guy if he wanted to. Right. But he explodes. And then he immediately, like, his face crumples. And his lip quivers, and he buries, like, his face in his hand, you know, and he tries his best to keep himself from crying. And it's such a – he's fantastic in the film, you know, especially in those moments, I think.
Agreed. I don't know what else to say. I mean, in the scenes with Patient X, I mean, I think that, you know, the book, I think you get the benefit of these – long kind of stream of consciousness diatribes in Kinderman's mind. And obviously that would be boring in the movie if Blatty had, written another character so Kinderman could constantly bounce those diatribes off of him or something like that. So I think a lot of that falls on Scott to sort of convey that, you know, and I think when Scott is sort of realizing that this is not on the up and up in terms of what, you know, this shouldn't be happening the way it's happening. It's like that sort of terror that comes into Scott, but it's understated. It's beautiful. It's not, it doesn't overplay like, "Oh my God, I'm so scared." Like there's none of that, but it's there, okay. You know? And that is probably the way that a career cop would deal with that, or at least could deal with that. And so, yeah, I mean, it's again, and I'm such just a big fan of, you know, that type of stuff when it's nuanced, it rewards multiple viewings because you you know, there's nothing spelling it out for you. So it's stuff that you discover on, you know, your third or fourth watch. And that sort of makes you want to go back and do a fourth and a fifth watch. And, but yeah, I just love watching him in those scenes with Patient X, because there's this sort of disbelief that becomes kind of existential horror. Like, you know, oh my God, like it's, this isn't, this can't be Karras. This can't be, oh my God, it's fucking Karras. And what, and it's just like what he does with just a look is incredible. And what that says about Kinderman's character and where he is as a character, is incredible with nothing in the script to back that up.
Oh yeah. Even when he discovers that it is Karras and he's walking down the hallway. I mean, by the time he stops and he's grabbed hold of, you know, his partner, like he spills it all. He lets us know what he's thinking and the fact that it's Karras and that, you know, again, they were best friends and, you know, all of that. But in the walk, like when he grabs the guy's arm, when he pulls him aside, the look on his face, it's like you realize that it's all dawning on him, that he's wrestling with that as best he can.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's you know, the way you might react if you found out a loved one died or something like that. Okay, we've all seen that reaction somewhere in life, and so that it's perfectly done. And one, you know, and I also love, I forget if it's in that moment or not, but when he punches the Gemini in the face, and then the nurse goes in, and you just hear his goddamn nose is broken, and. You know, what a ballsy stroke of confidence on Blatty's part to, you know, you're making a sequel, for all intents and purposes, you're making a sequel to, you know, the scariest movie ever made, the most terrifying film of all time. And you are not afraid one bit to pack that movie with some flat out hilarious moments, dialogue situations, like, yeah, I can't imagine doing that. You know, like the command of your project that you have to make that work. And the movie is still scary as hell at times.
It's the scariest jump scare I've ever seen in a film still.
Yeah, I mean, without a doubt, that moment is one of the greatest moments in the genre ever. But so you know, you can pull that off. You can pull off this sense of dread and then still be hilarious in moments. It's. I'm in awe. I don't know how you do that.
Well, and the fact, not only that he did it, but the fact that he did it so well, that he married those disparate tones, you know, throughout. It's like I wish he had made more movies. I feel like, you know, there are two directors that I wish had worked more, and he is certainly one of them. I'm such a Clive Barker fanboy, but, you know, you look at his stuff, you look at Hellraiser to Nightbreed and then Nightbreed to Lord of Illusions. And then I'm just like, where might that guy be now? He was making a leap as far as his, I know a lot of people don't consider Lord of Illusions to be better than, you know, I mean, Nightbreed has its cult following and Hellraiser is Hellraiser, you know, it's iconic. I get it. But I mean, as far as his strengths as a director go, I think Lord of Illusions is his strongest film. And, you know, that was his third film. What would his eighth film look like?
Right. At this point, I love Lord of Illusions too. I might be with you on that.
It's my favorite of his. I mean, I love Hellraiser. I love Nightbreed, but Lord of Illusions is his best known film.
You know, the director, I think there's a really good case to be made for the director's cut of that. I think if I were to nitpick, I think just some of the CGI in that really just sort of.
It is dodgy, but the great thing about the CG in that movie is that it's showing things that the things that he chooses to use CG with, we can excuse. Like if he had tried to CG a humanoid creature or a monster, I think it would be unforgivable, especially with mid-90s effects. But the fact that it's like a floating origami man on fire, like I can buy that. Like I am never pulled out of the movie, even in those moments.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. And the only reason I don't completely agree is because I love Hellraiser so much, but I do. I concede your point about, you're right. Like the confidence that he was showing, you know, piece by piece with each movie, he was only getting better. And it's awful that he stopped. I don't know quite why. I mean, they were always like, you know, starts and stops over the years of other stuff. And it sounded like some of them were like so close to happening.
Yeah. What was it like American Horror? back in the early aughts, sounded like it was going to be amazing. And then he was going to do the film adaptation of that Tortured Souls novella that was packaged with the McFarlane figures. I mean,
yeah, that's right.
Which could have been amazing. I actually adore that. Oh, my God. I collected each one of those figures. I didn't even give a damn about the toys. I just wanted the Barker short story that was included with each of them. And you put those all together, and it paints a world that would have been amazing to see on film. But
yeah, I kind of wish I had gotten those.
It's cool. I think you. I think the novella is available on like Kindle now for like $3.99, I think. So, but sorry, I'm going so far away from the main topic. But yeah, what I guess what I mean to say is, you know, if and I still need to see the ninth configuration, but you know, if The Exorcist 3 was only his second film, if he was that good on his second turn at bat, what would the rest of his films have looked like? You know, I made this point already before, but I it really makes me sad to think of all of the great cinema he might have given us.
And yeah, it's funny because they've always talked about, oh, it was, you know, originally Friedkin was sort of interested in coming back at first, but then he decided he didn't want to do, you know, he didn't want to compete with himself. And you know, at one point John Carpenter was circling the project, and I don't know how far that ever got. And those would have been interesting to see what a Friedkin sequel would have looked like, and what a Carpenter Exorcist movie would have looked like. But I don't know that anybody would have done anything better. And especially knowing that, like, my issues with the movie were, you know, studio imposed, and I think anybody would have had those particular issues. Namely, because your movie doesn't have an exorcism in it, and you want to call it The Exorcist. But, you know, I just don't know that, like, I don't know that anybody would have done that hallway scare. And that hallway scene is, I think, worth, you know, I don't know. I wouldn't trade that for anything.
Yeah. Oh, my God. That's my favorite jump scare of any movie. And it's not even a typical jump scare. It's not a cat jumping in the frame with a musical sting. It's not a shrieking violins as somebody, like, you know, I don't know, beats on a friend's window on their car. You know, it's nothing cheap. It's just holding on that hallway for the longest time. And then finally, when what is revealed, there's that slight push-in. As it happens, it's just brilliant. It's so brilliantly orchestrated and so ballsy that he allowed the movie to just, you know, because you're expecting something. He lulls you into, like, the sense of security by saying, a scare is coming. A scare is coming. A scare is coming. Just keep waiting for it. Just keep waiting.
There's that fake scare in the middle of it.
Yeah.
And you think, okay. And then nope. It's, you know, you the audience member, you're played perfectly. And it's more complex than I perhaps initially remembered, because there are other, like, you know, everybody remembers the nurse, but there's a security guard, and somebody else comes up behind the security guard, knocks on the door, and the security guard gets up and goes with them, but then the security guard comes back to get something. So, like, there's a lot more going on than just the nurse walking from door to door to door. And it's sort of amazing. I can't imagine, like, the logistics of that. Like how many times did it take to get that scene right? Because it's so great.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And it's just utterly chilling too. And I'm so glad that we didn't see the violence happen. You know, I mean, for the most part, it's not really a super gory film. It's not a terribly violent film. You know, the violence is suggested, or we see what's happened after the fact, or we see it nearly happening. There's the threat of it, you know, even,
right.
I mean, my God, near the very end when, you know, Kinderman saves, well, it's not he who saves his daughter, but when he goes back to his house and sees that everything is okay and thinks that he's losing his mind. And then his wife brings up the, what's this business with the nurse? And you see his jaw drop. And then there is that confrontation. And then the moment that, well, it wasn't a nurse, but the moment the patient brings up the shears.
Yep.
And I think the blades actually touch the daughter's neck as she is pulled out of the way of them clamping down. Like, my God, that moment.
It's great. And I mean, that's in the Legion version, that's basically the climax of the movie. You know, then you, in Exorcist 3, you get into the exorcism piece of it. But But no, it's a great moment, and it plays better actually in the movie, I think, than the book. I mean, it's just written in the movie. It's staged to be more, you know, it's milked for more suspense. That's all, and it's done well for the book in the book. But I think that Blatty rightly rejiggered it so that, you know, it's Kinderman in the car, and then the shot of the nurse in the backseat of the taxi with that growly music playing. I think it's built up perfectly for suspense in the movie, and then it's just a whew when it's over.
That's so great. We've talked about George C. Scott, and you mentioned on the Legion cut that we get a completely different Brad Dourif performance, which I can't wait to see, because honestly his performance in the theatrical cut is incredible. He is such an I don't feel like Dourif gets the credit he deserves for being as good an actor as he is.
Yeah, no, not at all. He doesn't. And that's always been a sore spot with me, because I think he's genuinely as good as any great actor. Like, I think he's as good as a De Niro.
Oh, totally.
Or Pacino. And for whatever reason, you know, he became relegated to, and I think it's because he's so good in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and Exorcist III, as these commanding lunatics, basically. I think it's unfair that he was sort of relegated to that. But unfortunately, he was.
Yeah, and it's such a shame. I mean, I keep waiting on some, you know, visionary director to come along and cast him in something that will make people look at him in a new light. And I was hoping, you know, even as a huge, you know, Child's Play fanboy back in the late 90s, by the time it was announced that he was going to be playing, a secondary villain to Christopher Lee's Saruman in Lord of the Rings, yeah, I was like, this is it. This is when people are going to see what this guy is capable of. It's going to be amazing, you know, and then and then not so much. I mean, hell, he was cut entirely out of the third film, you know, by the time it hit theaters. I mean, it's such a damn shame. I feel like there is a role waiting for that guy that is going to take full advantage of his talents. I hope it comes sooner rather than later, because, at least we have his older films, but it feels like he's too unloved for the most part.
Yeah, no, I agree. And every time I watch Exorcist 3, you know, I go through that, where it's like, and one thing where the Legion cut is, I think, again, I wish they had the means to do a proper, you know, restoration of it, because I think then you'd really know. But I mean, you know, Blatty gives him, it's him, it's Dourif. There's no special effects in those sequences. So I don't even think there's a shot of like yellow eyes or of fluctuation in voice, although maybe there's a little fluctuation in voice. It's the two versions are kind of married together in my head at this point. But for the most part, the Dourif moments are just Dourif, and just the camera holds on him. There's not, to my memory, a lot of reaction shots from Kinderman. It's just Dourif, almost like he's talking to us. And it, they play a little differently, a little more, you know, they're a little more personal. And when he's just sort of looking at you, you know, the royal you, it's I don't know, it has a kind of a strange kind of seductive quality. Like, you're really drawn into it, this personal, almost like a dialogue that you're having with the Gemini killer. It's a really interesting effect. And I don't know, I kind of get why Blatty was okay with that. You know, like, he didn't see a need to use Jason Miller. But I also get why, from a marketing standpoint, you would want Jason Miller to be, you know, in your movie. And there, it's funny, because on the Blu-ray there are conflicting stories. I think the documentary and then the Blatty interview, it's tough to piece together kind of the politics of when everything happened. But, you know, Blatty, according to Dourif, Blatty hired him to be Damian Karras originally, right? And so it was going to be all Dourif all the time. Gemini, Karras, whatever, Dourif. And that was always the plan. Blatty says in his interview that he had wanted Jason Miller, but Jason Miller was unavailable, quote, unavailable. I kind of buy that, too, because Blatty worked with Miller, again, on Ninth Configuration. He had him in that film, too. So it kind of makes sense that they, you know, he already, clearly he would know what he's in for with Jason Miller at this point.
Sure.
But then Brad Dourif says something interesting where, and it goes back to what you'd mentioned earlier, that his health wasn't great. And why that was because he had become a really severe alcoholic, and it was wet brain basically was preventing him from being able to deliver those long lines of dialogue. So we don't, you know, then I'm sort of wondering, okay, well, was that the real reason? And was that like Blatty just being diplomatic or what, you know, we don't know. But then they talk about when the studio decided to do reshoots, that was when they decided to cut Brad Dourif. I guess the original plan was to cut Brad Dourif out of the movie entirely and to do the entire reshoots with Jason Miller only as Patient X.
Oh, wow.
And then somebody else mentions that, but that's when Miller couldn't do everything on his own. So then they decided, okay, well, we have to get Dourif back too. But because they had rebuilt the set somewhere else, the background didn't match, so that's why Dourif actually had to give a completely different performance. So in the finished Exorcist 3 that was in theaters, all the Dourif stuff you're getting was from that reshot version. And then the Legion cut is the original stuff.
Now, I got to ask, between the two performances, which do you think is the stronger?
It's tough to say because it's Brad Dourif, and he's fucking great, and so it's compelling either way, you know what I mean? Blatty seems to feel that the original stuff was much better, but I feel like that's kind of, I think that's doing a disservice because he still got great work out of Dourif, you know, in the reshoots, and I do like the Jason Miller stuff. So, you know, again, I know what Blatty's intent there was, but I don't know. I liked seeing Jason Miller again. So it's hard for me to say that, you know, I don't know. It's a weird thing because, like, on one hand, I hate studio reshoots and stuff, and I do think the exorcism itself it's a little too late 80s, very slick, like the effects. I don't think it needed to, you know, the stuff with Father Morning melting or whatever, that's just a little too Freddy Krueger-ish in a way. And I don't think it was needed, but as you said already, like there's some striking moments with Jason Miller there that, like, it's hard to say that they made completely the wrong call, because I really like some of that stuff a lot. So I don't know. I'm super conflicted on the movie. I think where I land is, like, the theatrical cut is still the cut to go to, especially when you're showing somebody new. And then Legion is sort of the weird aberration. It's a really interesting curiosity piece, especially for fans of the movie and book, but I don't think it's all the way there, unfortunately.
So it's not really, I mean, you know, when you look at the Nightbreed release, you get an either or sort of choice. You can go with theatrical or you can go with directors. And honestly, as a longtime fan of the theatrical cut, which I thought was great over the years, but, you know, I'm going with the director's cut from here on out. There's really no need to go back to the original cut at this point. Whereas it sounds like what you're saying with The Exorcist 3 is that it's not a replacement. It's just a really great bonus feature.
Totally. That's exactly it. Yeah. And then, unfortunately, I mean, and like you, like, I don't want to be hard on Scream Factory here because I'm really happy I got to see it. But I just wanted it to be better. I wanted it to be that replacement, you know.
And same here. I mean, maybe, you know, Scream Factory, if you're listening, I know you're not, but if you are, someday, one day, if they were to stumble across the film elements, you know.
Oh, I'm sure there'd be another, I guess, you know, another release, and I would welcome it.
I will buy that copy, too. I'll buy the one that you just put out. I will buy the remastered version. You know, if you find the 35, I will buy probably any version you put out. I'm completely cool with The Exorcist 3 being trotted out once every couple of years if need be.
No, I'm with you. And it, I mean, for what it's worth, it's a great disc. I mean, even the archival stuff that they've got on disc one, which is just some you know, EPK interviews. Well, they're better than EPK, but interviews with, you know, George C. Scott, Jason Miller. I mean, it's Blatty. It, it's good stuff. I mean, and then you get, you know, the new documentary is, I think it's in 5 or 6 parts, but it's all told, it's about 1 hour and 45 minutes. Then you have a audio interview with Blatty that runs that length. So you got, there's a lot of stuff to go through, and all of it was very good. So it's a great release. And I would say to anybody who has even a modicum of interest in Exorcist 3, like, this is the edition to buy. I mean, it's very, very good.
I can't wait. All right. So to start wrapping up, I got to say, like, looking at the franchise, you know, I love the original Exorcist and I love part 3, which I'm not trying to be like a snob about this or whatever, but in my mind, because, you know, the Blatty books are The Exorcist and Legion, you know, so right. Far as I'm concerned, like the film franchise is The Exorcist and Legion. I don't really need it to be The Exorcist 3. So in my mind, the franchise is comprised of those two movies, and the rest are pretty much well-funded fan fiction for me.
Yeah.
You know, I can occasionally pull out, like, I don't know if I'm ever going to watch The Heretic again. Honestly, after this conversation, I might give it another shot. Like, I might just start with the first film and work my way through the entire franchise again. But even, you know, looking at, you know, The Beginning and Dominion, you know, I don't hate either one of those movies.
No, I don't either.
But I feel no need to ever revisit them. You know, I mean, I know that they exist and that's enough for me. Like, there's nothing in those movies that compels me to check them out, which is kind of depressing because, you know, I previewed the Harlan film when it came out and I watched it and I was like, that was not terrible, but I never need to see it again. And I'm sure that Paul Schrader's version is so much better because he's such an artist. And, it, you know, that was the original cut of the movie that the studio balked at, and they wanted a much bigger movie. And I'm sure his version is just going to be incredible. And then you watch it and it's fine too. You know, yeah. It's okay. It's all right. Yeah. You know, they're both all right. So, but I got to ask, you know, what is your opinion overall, like, on the entire franchise, those sequels, and what is your opinion on the television series that's currently playing on Fox?
Yeah, I'm with you. I think you probably won't get a lot out of The Heretic if you watch it again. I mean, that's sort of the thing, is like, I'm intrigued that they made it. I'm fascinated by weird movies like that were of a certain, I mean, that movie was in a time where sequels were not handled the same way that sequels are handled now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like, it was this weird thing, and somebody thought that's how you would do a follow-up to The Exorcist. Very, very strange. But I will say that, you know, especially on the Blu-ray, you can really appreciate the visually, it's such an interesting-looking film, and there's some knockout cinematography in it. And that's, I think, it's saving grace, if it even has any, is just that, like, you know, it's a really artistic failure of a movie. And it's a mess, but
made, man, by a very good filmmaker. I mean,
it's a very good filmmaker.
Noting that John Borman is a hell of a director, and he was an inspired choice to direct an Exorcist sequel. So
absolutely, which makes it even all the stranger that they ended up with just this weird pile of nothing. And it is kind of a pile of nothing. It's, you know, every time I watch it, I think, like I said, I'm of the mind, like, well, maybe I just haven't grasped what's in here. And then at the end of it, I'm always like, nope, you know, your instincts are right. Stop trying to mine this movie for depths it doesn't have. And I agree with you completely on The Beginning and Dominion. I saw Dominion. Remember I saw The Beginning in theaters. Remember how bad the early word of mouth on that movie was?
Like, oh, it was, yeah, scathing.
It was toxic. And I went with a few friends expecting the worst, and I mean, it was perfectly watchable.
Yeah.
You know, nothing, what's his name? Stellan Skarsgård was very good in it.
Yeah, yeah.
But
it's beautifully, like, shot.
Yeah, it's well shot. The subterranean church there is a really cool set piece. I've actually tried to watch it again, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, or maybe 5 years ago, whatever. And I got about halfway through it and stopped it for whatever reason and just never felt like I had to go back to watch it.
That's that life's too short moment with some movies, man.
It's just like, yeah, you know, it's okay. It's still okay. But I don't, so I'm kind of with you. In Dominion, sort of feel the same way. I respect Dominion. I think Dominion's a little better, only in the sense that it, like the Blatty movies, it has something to say. I don't think it gets all the way there, and it's kind of half baked and poorly realized. But at least in true to Blatty's Exorcist stories, it's got sort of a commentary. It's got something to say about faith and more than that, which I appreciate the sort of effort there, and that brings me to the television series, which, if I'm being honest, my biggest problem with is that after five episodes, I don't think it has much to say. And I will reserve judgment until it's finished. But I just feel like, you know, I want The Exorcist to be a little loftier than, you know, other franchises. And you know, I've heard people on Twitter say, well, it's better than the beginning. Well, let's aim a little higher than that, you know?
Let's respect the original film. That's a classic.
Right. I don't know. Like, it's not bad, but I wish it was a little more ambitious in its message. I wish it kind of took more of a page from Blatty. Like, you don't have to copy Blatty. Like, Blatty's voice is inherently Blatty. Like, I'm not looking for that. But I mean, I don't know. Give me something a little more to chew on, you know? And it, so far it's not doing that, really.
No, I agree. I got to admit, I was kind of blindsided by the show because I expected it to be terrible.
And so did I. I think I said to you on Twitter before it came out, I said, I won't watch a frame of it.
Yeah. And I honestly tuned into the pilot with the expectation that I would be able to say after that hour, hey, I gave it a shot, I'm done. But the fact that it was competently made and the fact that it wasn't, you know, it's not simply trading on all the things that it wasn't like a straight-faced Repossessed in a way that plays on all the greatest hits of the original Exorcist film. Well, we have the pea soup and we have the turning head and we have the power of Christ compels you and we have all of that nonsense. You know, it felt like watching that pilot that you had somebody who was trying to inhabit that world but do something different with it. And so I was impressed enough with that I was willing to give it a shot. But you're right, we're now five episodes in and it doesn't feel like they're doing anything more than telling a fun story. You know, you look at Harlan's The Beginning. You're right. You compare it to the Dominion film that the original cut that Schrader made. Schrader was trying to say something. Harlan was telling a story where the character had an arc. He did have an arc. Like, there was an arc to Marin in that film. But just because your lead character has an arc, that doesn't necessarily imbue your movie or the story you're telling with any greater meaning. And I feel like that's what's happening with the Exorcist television series. I mean, Father Marcus is clearly on his own path. And, you know, the younger priest who, I mean, maybe this is telling in itself. I don't even remember his name.
But it feels like Tomas?
Tomas, yeah. It's Alfonso Herrera's character. I know the actor. I don't know the character. But it feels like he's on his own path. And I will say that the characters feel like, you know, some effort has gone into, you know, making them a little three-dimensional, giving them a bit of depth, giving them their own paths to walk. But yeah, you're right. There is no greater theme being chewed on yet with that series. But you know what? When you're 5 hours in, I don't care how long the series is. I don't care if it's 8 episodes, 10 episodes, 13, 22. If you're at hour five and you're not showing glimpses of any greater meaning, then you're probably not interested in it in the first place. And yet, I would be willing to forgive that if it were still enjoyable. And it is enjoyable to me. Like, I've enjoyed the last five episodes quite a bit, actually. I think it's been fun. I despise the damn CG. The CG is awful. Like, yeah. I miss the days of CG Jackals from Dominion. And like, and plus, it's stuff that doesn't even need to be CG'd. It's like, guys, can we not get a centipede wrangler? Let's go ahead and let's try a little harder than what we're doing, because that looks like dog shit. You have a beautifully shot show with great actors. You're actually doing something kind of interesting, and now you're completely pulling me out of it because you were too damn lazy to spend an extra hour on set with real practical effects. Anyway, sorry, rant over. But
no, I mean you're one. I think you and I are on the same page with the show entirely. I mean, I'm hot and cold on it. You know what I mean? Like, I will watch probably the whole season because I think that, yeah, it's not bad. And in fact, there are things about it that are quite good. A friend of mine I was chatting with, and I leveled this, my same criticism to him. I just said, you know, I want more out of The Exorcist than sort of just the sort of, you know, year one of screenwriting, give every character an arc and you know, this and that. Yeah. Because, you know, yeah, it is kind of interesting. The actors are very good. It's hard for me to separate. It still seems sort of like Blatty's book rejiggered to be a soap opera in a weird way. Like Karras is Tomas. They have the same, I suspect they'll have a similar trajectory, or at least so far they do, in that, you know, they're haunted by something in their past. They're trying to walk the path of God, but you know, Karras was losing his faith, and Tomas, I don't know that he's losing his faith much more.
I think his faith is there. He's just becoming a fallen priest, I think, bit by bit.
He's being tempted by the flesh, which is much more sort of just lowbrow in a way. I mean, not that that's not believable. Like, that could be a thing, but it just feels when it fits alongside everything else, it's sort of just in step with that. Like the other priest character who is very good, and the actor is very good. Like I said, he's Marin with a gun in a way. Like,
which is God, can we just talk about the damn gun for a second?
Well, that's the moment where I almost shut it off in the first episode.
Same here. They almost lost me right there.
Because I think I tweeted, and I think you had seen it because I think you liked the tweet or something, but I said sort of nothing sums up storytelling in 2016, you know, more succinctly than having a priest pull a gun on another priest. It's just sort of like, you know, I know you have to establish this is a modern show and this and that, but like, come on.
It was terrible.
And yeah, it was such a overreach.
I mean, what did that moment sell? Here's the thing. I don't even understand why it was there, because at no point do we believe he's going to kill the priest. There's no danger there whatsoever. And we, you know, if that moment was supposed to sell that he's edgier and a bit more of a badass than a typical priest, we already know that from the preceding 5 minutes, you know, how he's dealt right with the demon inhabiting that boy. So I don't know, unless they needed him to get in trouble with the Catholic Church, which is a plot point, but it's like, you couldn't think of a better way to do that than having him pull a 45 that he had to have been packing in the first place.
Like, this priest is so serious about his exorcisms that he has a gun. It's just, it seemed a bit much. I didn't necessarily buy into it. And again, you know, so I was saying to my friend, like, you know, it's very much to me, I don't know. This sounds worse than I mean it. Like, but it's kind of a dumbed down Exorcist in a way. Like, it's William Peter Blatty's book without the introspection. Without, you know, Blatty always says the Exorcist is his the first part of his loose trilogy. You know, and the Exorcist being the mystery of faith, and the Ninth Configuration being the mystery of good, and Legion being the problem of evil. You know, and going back to the Exorcist as the mystery of faith, like, you know, that's if that's his jumping off point, that's incredibly well realized through his characters, through everything that happens in that book, right? I mean, it's perfectly realized. And Friedkin brings it to screen perfectly. And I don't know if you were to say, you know, for the Fox show, what's the theme?
No clue.
There really isn't one.
They would probably say good versus evil, but it's like, come on.
Right. It's like, that's so college, you know, screenwriting. My friend had the point, and I agreed. He said, you know, well, one of the interesting things about the show is it's set in Chicago. And, you know, and I think for me, the most interesting aspect of the show is the cult of murderers so far, because that's I wasn't expecting that, and that's something different than we've seen in this series so far. So that to me made me go, "Ooh, what is this all about?" But my friend said, "Well, one of the comments that the show is making is, you know, and it's kind of looking at Chicago, all the awful, you know, gun violence and deaths that occur there regularly. And he's like, the fact that there's this horrible ritualistic murder spree happening in Chicago and nobody cares. And that's very much kind of a modern take on, you know, what's happening. And I thought, but it's not, I mean, that's probably,
it's not dealing with that in any interesting way, I don't think.
Right. It's, if it's in there, it's in there in a very sort of superfluous kind of way. Like, yeah, that's, you know, we're commenting on the headlines of today, but you know, the show's not about that really. You know, so I don't know that you could sell that as a theme. And yeah, I mean, I just, it's a weird show because I do find it interesting. Like, and I like watching it from week to week, but I also am kind of like, ah, something's missing from it. And I'm sure you want to talk about the ending of the last episode, but I don't know, that made me like it even less.
Same here. So many people seem to be, it felt like people jumped on board even more with the, okay, let me go ahead. Okay, listeners, if you're checking this out, I don't know when this episode is going to go up, but at the time of this recording, the fifth episode of The Exorcist has just played, and there was a big twist, or not so much a twist as a revelation at the end of the fifth episode. If you have not seen the first season of The Exorcist, skip ahead by about 2 or 3 minutes, or maybe just stop now, watch the show, and then come back later, because we are going to talk about it at length, I think. Not at length, but maybe for a minute or two. But yeah, that thing. I missed watching it on Friday. So for whatever reason, it wasn't spoiled for me. That was somehow incredible. I mean, on Twitter, when you knew who died in The Walking Dead, literally, there are people I followed, man. There are people I trust. And here's the thing. I unfollowed people over them ruining The Walking Dead, because here's the thing. I was watching The Walking Dead. It didn't ruin a thing for me, but they've told me that I can't trust them. And so I had to get rid of them.
Yeah.
Now, that may sound mean, but I got to do what I got to do. But for all of that, I mean, for as many people as I follow that watch The Exorcist, everyone came out with, oh my God, the twist is incredible. The twist is amazing. Can you believe that twist? Oh my God, the bombshell that was dropped at the end of that episode. And nobody ruined it. God bless them. Nobody I follow. And I couldn't wait. I was like, my God, what could it be? You know, when I saw the Bible, I was like, oh, no. No, please, no. Please. Here's the thing. I am a sucker for continuity. I am a continuity fiend. Like, I hate reboots because I think there's a way to reboot a franchise that honors what's come before while resetting the story for new viewers. I think you can do that, and I think it's most of the time, I think it's laziness when a reboot happens that just says, we're just going to wipe the slate clean and start all over. Fuck that. I like the idea of continuing a story that's gone on for decades, right? So I was excited when in that pilot episode, you see somebody researching the notion of demonic possession and exorcisms, and you see that photo of the Georgetown steps. And I was like, yes, that's all I need. That's all I need. You're telling me that you're not rewriting the original film series. You're acknowledging that this is the same universe. Now you can do whatever the hell you want. And I am on your side, at least for that.
I agree. You and I, again, have the same reaction. I thought if this becomes an ongoing series, maybe we'll see Linda Blair as Reagan at some point.
How cool would that have been?
And that would be neat to see what Reagan's up to.
So we should go ahead and say at the end of episode 5, it's revealed that Geena Davis's character, who is the mother of the possessed teenager in the show, is in fact Regan McNeil. So we have another actress playing an iconic role, once inhabited by an actress who is still very much alive and would probably appreciate the work and would probably maybe kick ass in said role if given the opportunity. But not only that, not only did they recast Reagan, but at the very end, in a really, really, I can't say this enough, really stupid sequence.
That's what even was worse for me. Oh, I laughed out loud.
It was terrible. Chris McNeil, who was once played by Ellen Burstyn, now played by Sharon Gless. Let me say that again. Ellen Burstyn, now played by Sharon Gless, is, I'm not knocking the actress, I'm just saying, come on, Ellen Burstyn is still out there, damn it. But she shows up in silhouette wearing wearing a hat that makes her look like Father Marin in all of the marketing materials in that iconic scene from the original movie. She shows up as Chris McNeil, and now you have a television series that is set in the same world as the original movie, but you have recast the two iconic roles in that movie. And now your Exorcist television series, and keep in mind, I just said I'm a continuity fiend. I should appreciate this, but now it feels like a cheap TV movie knockoff of The Exorcist.
That's exactly what you said the other night, and I was like, oh, that's very succinct.
It's Patty Duke, and look what's happened to Rosemary's Baby.
Yes, yep. And my problem with it is, you know, if you're watching The Exorcist on Fox, the new series, and you haven't seen the old film, and this isn't their fault. I don't mean to say that it is, and that you have to account for new viewers, but that doesn't mean anything to you.
No.
You know, it's like, okay, so who cares? Like if you're a newbie to this, and the show certainly is, you know, trying to build a following, then you know, it's sort of like, oh, okay, you know, who the fuck is Reagan McNeil?
Exactly. And you piss off fans and you alienate new viewers. It's literally the most destructive thing they could have done at that point in the season.
And I've seen a lot of people that are, I guess never underestimate the lure of fan service just in the name of fan service, because it's sort of like the you know, if I had to kind of liken it to something, it's sort of like all the people that did trailer reactions to themselves watching the Star Wars Force Awakens trailer and screaming and screeching and crying at the sight of the Millennium Falcon just because it's the Millennium Falcon. And I'm sort of like, okay, you're excited because Geena Davis is Reagan McNeil. But why? Why are you excited? It doesn't do anything for that story. The story, I mean, if anything, all it does is it corrects a problem I had with the first episode. And that was that I thought the Geena Davis character went from zero to holy fuck, we need an exorcism very quickly.
Totally. I kind of appreciated that in the sense that I was like, okay, we're not going to have to handle an episode or two episodes or even three episodes of her being trotted out to doctors and getting tested. I love that it was immediately like
recreating the Ellen Burstyn arc in the first movie. We've seen that, so you don't have to do that again.
But I do agree. It was way too fast, and it does make sense now because it is Reagan. But at the same time, I will say that I kind of appreciated that in a way because it was simply like, you know, you see things. I mean, how many times in a horror movie have you seen horror movie tropes being trotted out and everyone is still trying to rationalize it as being anything but the supernatural or whatever? I did love in the pilot episode, she was basically like, you know, her daughter starts acting a little strangely and she's like, fucking demon. Need an exorcist right now, you know.
Before, post Reagan twist, I was sort of just like, I just wanted like a line of dialogue or something. Like, I have taken her to every doctor. I have, you know, like that would have been fine with that. You know what I mean? But you're right. I mean, it makes sense now in hindsight, five episodes later. Oh, okay.
But it doesn't justify that twist.
I don't think the twist is justified. A couple people I talked to think it was earned, but I think that, again, I go back to one of the things you said, which is, you know, we've got, now there's another spinning cup, and there's already a lot of spinning cups on a show that I don't know how many episodes we're getting this season, but I'm assuming it's going to be
information out there anywhere, because I swear every podcast I listen to and everything I read on Twitter, everyone's like, how many episodes is it? How many episodes is it? I looked it up on Wikipedia and they only have listed through like episode 7. It's like, how are they going to add episodes at some point? Were they planning on doing that mid-season sort of extension? Because just watching it, I'm not getting any sense of it wrapping up or, you know, it could go for 10 episodes. It could go for 13. It could go for 18. I have no fucking clue.
Yeah. I don't know, but I would assume, I mean, I think it's probably safe to assume 13 episodes. I mean, I don't know why I assume that actually, but it just seems like that's sort of in vogue now. And if we go with that, and we're not quite halfway there, but we're 5 hours in. That's a long time, and I don't know. I mean, I feel like that's a lot of stuff to contend with.
You should be resolving things at this point, as opposed to introducing new arcs, as it were, because that's certainly what it's going to be with Reagan. You know that the next episode is going to be all about recapping the events of the original movie and catching people up who haven't seen it, you know?
Right.
And it's just, that's going to burn an episode that doesn't need to be burned at this point in the story. And, you know, it tosses in one more wrinkle that really isn't going to serve the story in any way, on top of, you know, you have a young priest's fall from grace. You have Father Marcus, the older priest, and his quest for redemption, it feels like. You have the possession. You have the cult that's been hinted at. You have the impending Pope's visit. And is the Pope evil or not? Or is the Pope being targeted by the cult? And now you have Reagan McNeil and her mother. It's like, why? Why do that? And why not cast the original actresses? Or why not attempt that? Yeah, it would have done away with the twist. But imagine, okay, listeners out there, if you're hating us right now for bashing this series, because a lot of people do seem to love this series, but consider this for a second. Imagine the exact same show with Linda Blair playing whatever the hell Reagan's name is when it's not Reagan. I don't remember the character names, and that's, I think, probably telling in itself, but that aside. Imagine that, though. Imagine that we know from minute one that it's her. Does the show lose anything at that point? Would it not, in fact, be cooler to finally catch up with that character as an adult in this franchise? Since, you know, we haven't seen her since the second film. How neat would it have been to have done that? And not mention the mother. If you want a twist, or if you want an added wrinkle at the end of episode 5, have her finally get called on being Reagan. Have her husband find out. Have her finally confessing to the priest who she really is. And then have Ellen Burstyn show up as her mother. Would that not be a stronger way to have done it?
Well, yeah, because, I mean, I don't know what was gained by withholding that information from us for 5 episodes.
Or, God forbid, let it not be Reagan at all. Let it be just a completely different story.
That's what I mean. That, to me, and again, I don't mean to be like a Monday morning quarterback on the people creating the show, because believe me, if somebody said to me, you know, Matt Serafini, we want to hire you to do The Exorcist on television, I would jump at the chance too.
Oh, yeah. And it is, but, you know, I think I read Clive Barker say once that, like, he, you know, the worst way to criticize something is to say what you would have done instead. But, you know, as a fanboy, I can't help but say how I feel it would have been a stronger way to approach that particular plot point. But sorry, that aside.
No. And I mean, for me personally, I was sort of just hoping, like, you know, we've got the Reagan story, you know, and obviously we've got Legion, and we've got less successful movies as well. but I was just sort of like, okay, cool. So they've established pretty early on in the first episode that this is set in the world of The Exorcist, you know, that Reagan's exorcism was a thing in the '70s. And I was fine with that because, again, I was just thinking, like, well, if this goes on to a long running show, the possibilities are kind of endless, you know, in terms of having Reagan join the cast, you know, Linda Blair join the cast. And I don't know, I guess I would have preferred a combination of a show that sort of was carving its own path, and maybe it would hitch up again later. But I felt like, you know, establishing your new characters, your new story for 5 episodes, and then saying, you know, oh, and then just kidding, this is really Reagan's story still. I don't know. It just rubbed me the wrong way. I don't feel like anything's gained from that, from having that information. A friend of mine said, well, now we know that the demon wants her, meaning Reagan, as opposed to the other daughter, because the possessed teenager kept saying, you know, well, bring me to her. And apparently you thought, you know, that meant that the other daughter, I happen to always think it was Gina Davis that the demon wanted. And I don't think that we've spent enough time with the other daughter for that to really make a difference anyway. So I don't know. I don't think that that was a big deal. Like, I don't think, oh my God, no, the demon doesn't want the daughter. It wants the mom. Like, who cares? I mean, I don't know. I just like, not enough time has been spent to make that a big deal. So I don't know. I guess my question is just, why did it have to be Reagan? And what does withholding that information until episode 5 really do? I don't think it does anything.
You know, it's weird. I agree with you entirely, but at the same time, I think we're in the minority, weirdly enough.
Well, that's fine. I mean, I'm used to being on the other end of issues.
But, I was telling you before, I'm wondering at what point Scott Wilson will show up as Kinderman.
Yeah, I know. And I said, yes, because Kinderman should always be 60 years old. The world moves on, but Kinderman is just 60.
There's something comforting about it.
Yeah, he's just always Bill Kinderman, grumpy 60-year-old DC cop. I don't know. I'm curious to see where it goes. I don't think it's doing that well in the ratings, so I don't know that we'll get another season. But obviously that's for somebody else to say, not me. But I wouldn't be surprised if this is a one and done.
Yeah, speaking of the devil, Scott Wilson and bad ratings, did you watch Damien by any chance?
I didn't, namely because most of the people I knew that did watch it told me it was terrible.
It was, but it was terrible in a fascinating way. Like, it was beautifully shot. Like, it's a very dark-looking show, and the lead actor was actually very good. It had a decent cast. It was obvious that money was put into the show, and it was kind of a neat idea to pick up with Damien. I hate that they did the Texas Chainsaw 3D math for him, you know, where you're flashing back to the events of the original 70s movie with clips of, you know, Gregory Peck and, you know, the boy who played, you know, the original Damien, and you see film clips from the original movie, and yet he's 25, 30 years old, but also it's the present day. It's like, guys. And that's not even the worst part of it, though. It's just it had everything going for it. I mean, the basic concept was great. It sounded like it was going to be a cool continuation of that franchise. Good lead actor, great looking show. Storytelling was abysmal.
Which surprises me, because wasn't it Glenn Mazzara,
yes,
the showrunner?
Yeah, when I saw his name, I was like, oh, we're good. It's going to be great. It'll be fine. And then, oh my goodness, it is shockingly bad at times. But what's crazy is that it felt like, I mean, it had a rocky start. Like, I don't understand whoever makes the call to send pilots to series. I don't understand the people who watched that pilot and said, yes, this is fine. I mean, there are so many head slapping moments in that opening pilot. It's just like, guys, you got something here, but it's half baked. It's quarter baked. It's honestly, you haven't put it into the fucking oven yet, but it could be something. And it felt like by the end of that season, I think it was only like 6 or 8 episodes. It was something very short, but it felt like they were finally starting to get a little bit of a toehold, a little bit of footing where maybe the second season might've been great. But at that point, I think people had tuned out in droves. So,
and it was canceled. It was definitely,
yeah, it's done.
Oh, okay.
And I don't think The Exorcist is going to have the same fate. It seems like people are digging it enough that Fox will probably roll the dice on giving it a second season. I mean, what the hell do I know? But I mean, just from having watched stuff like this happen all the time, I get the feeling that we're probably at least going to get a second season, because, you know, it is Fox and it is such a big name, you know.
And you're right. People, I'm just surprised at the, you know, using it in the same sentence as Hannibal and stuff. I'm just like, guys, let's not be crazy here. I mean, that's crazy talk.
I mean, I will admit, I have used, you know, when I illustrate like the notion of, you know, big screen franchises, horror franchises going to television, inevitably the two that immediately pop to mind are, you know, The Exorcist and Hannibal. I mean, Hannibal because it works so damn well, and The Exorcist because, you know, it's current, it's new. But yeah, as far as quality goes, no.
Yeah, that's my feeling too. And I, you know, I'm glad people are digging it, because it's cool that there's a new Exorcist out there that people like. But yeah, I don't know. I guess I just wish it was a little richer of an experience, and, you know, didn't give in to sort of the television temptations of, you know, feeding the water cooler twists, and I don't know.
I agree. But I will say, if I can't say one thing in the show's defense, it had a much more solid start than I was expecting.
And it did.
It does have a lot of promise, even for all of my problems with it. I do think that there's a chance that if the show does keep going, I could see a second season of the show being great. I could see them learning from some of the mistakes and, you know, listening to some of the criticisms that have been hurled at it so far. I could see that polishing the show and making it better. And I could see the show becoming maybe amazing down the line. But as it is right now, I'm watching week to week and I'm digging it week to week. But you're right. It doesn't hold a candle to the better entries in the franchise, you know?
Yeah, and I don't, I mean, you know, again, to me, it's like, okay, yeah, if you're going to say, oh, it's better than The Heretic and two prequels that barely anybody likes, it's, again, I'm like, okay. Yeah, like, you know, well, then shit, give it 8 seasons. I don't know. I mean, I want better. And you're right. I share your sentiments. I think that it could become better. And I think if it does get another season or two or however long, like I wouldn't be surprised if it found its footing and became really great. But we're not there yet, I don't think.
And what sucks is there is no undoing that twist. There's no undoing that decision. There's no undoing that recasting. So no matter how good it gets, it's always going to rub me the wrong way just a little bit, I think.
Me too. I think, I mean, you know, whatever. Gina Davis is Reagan McNeil. Whatever. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. Again, I don't know. I feel like I didn't need to see her at this point in the story, but, you know.
I agree.
What's done is done. Bell hath been rung.
All right. Well, sir, I think we're pretty much nearing the end of our time here. Can I ask, do you have any final parting thoughts on The Exorcist 3?
I know a lot of people that haven't seen this movie yet.
What?
I do. I know people that, for whatever reason, have that sequel stigma. And, I with the Scream Factory Blu-ray, by the time this show airs, obviously, it'll have been out for some time. I you know, check it out. You know, I really implore you people out there, please see it. It's I don't know, it's a movie that deserves to be discovered, and I think it was always sort of well regarded, but it's been interesting to see it sort of its reputation solidify over the years since its release and become a movie that is very well regarded now and well respected. I think in most circles.
Yeah. I cannot argue with that. Well, I can't think of any better way to end than on that note. Thank you so much for being on the show and for choosing The Exorcist 3 to talk about. And can I ask, where can folks find you at online, and what can they keep an eye out for from you in the future?
Thank you. Everywhere. I'm on Twitter, obviously. You can type my name into Amazon. You can get all my books. And I have a not very current website, mattserafini.com. I always tell myself I'm going to do more blog posts there, and then I don't. But, you know, links to all my books there and everything. And, what to look forward to. I have a new book coming out early next year called Neon Nights, which is sort of a rape revenge road trip romance love story in a really horrible way kind of a story. I guess that's a really awful way to sell it. I haven't practiced my my pitch line for it yet.
No, hey, you sold me. I think that sounds cool.
but yeah, that's my next one, and that's probably February or March of next year. So keep an eye out for that.
Rock on.
And thank you for having me. I will talk Exorcist 3 all day long, and even better to talk about it with you.
Thanks again, and thanks to all you listeners out there. Please be sure to like, subscribe, share, maybe write us in the comments section below, or leave us an iTunes review. Check out our YouTube show. If we get enough views, we'll possibly make some more someday. Be sure to purchase The Exorcist 3 or Mr. Serafini's books using the Amazon links below. And remember, any purchase you make through our Amazon links will keep this podcast going, so thanks for that. Also, find that Audible deal on our site. If you sign up for a free 30-day trial, you'll get 2 free books. Till next time, gang, thanks so much, and have a great weekend.
Oh, gracious me. Was I raving? Please forgive me. I'm mad.